Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to the 46th George Antonius Memorial Lecture. Starting back in 1976, when the great George Mactesey delivered the inaugural lecture on the origin and development of the college in Islam and the West, the Antonius Lecture has served as the culminating event of the academic year for the Middle East Center community. It's a family gathering of Center Fellows, of our students, of our staff, of our alumni, and of the broader friends and family in Oxford and in London and the near abroad that gathers once a year, like so many migratory birds, for the Antonius Lecture. We've come together for such inspirational lectures as that given by Albert Hourani, who was our second speaker, Afaf Marceau, our fourth, Magdi Wahba, our sixth, the great art historian Oleg Grabar, our ninth, impressive Palestinian intellectuals like Edward Said or Rashid Hanini, architect Zaha Hadid, in whose hall we sit now, she too was an Antonius, and recently Noam Chomsky. Only region-wide turmoil during the 2011 Arab uprisings or the lockdowns of COVID-19 were to break the rhythm of the annual gathering of the Antonius Lecture. So we missed out on Jeremy Bowen's lecture in 2011. We missed out on Hoda Barakat's lecture with COVID-19. Other than that, it's been a pretty continuous, we're getting very near our 50th anniversary of Antonius's. Now, the current academic year has in many ways been one of the hardest and most divisive of recent memory. The academic year began on the 9th of October, 2 days after the October 7th attacks. And the Gaza War has cast a long shadow over our community for the whole year. The year ends tomorrow. We will have had the entire year under the impact of the Gaza War. A war of unprecedented length and violence in the whole history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The violence has had a profound and divisive impact on Oxford, as it has on universities across Europe and North America. Free speech, free assembly, and the right to protest have come head to head with concerns about the rise of anti-Semitism on our campuses, and the resulting divisions have threatened the foundations of our university communities among students, between students and faculty, between faculty and the administration. As a center, we have tried to preserve a space for discussion, to preserve the bonds of community, to press the university to engage with the students, to find common ground. And I'd actually like to break with tradition to take a moment to thank colleagues who have made a difference this year. I would like to single out the amazing work of our emeritus colleague, Avi Schlein, who has responded to every request for a teach-in, for a seminar, for an interview, and who has been a beacon of reason in the fog of war. We salute you, Avi. I would also like to recognize the amazing work of Walter Armbrust, who has been at the forefront of dialogue with our students in the encampments and in its meetings between faculty and university officials, and trying to bring reason to the unreasonable, in being a rock that everyone can rely on, and for demonstrating, I think, to our student community the commitment of their faculty backing them. I think Walter's been amazing this year. Take a moment to commend our graduate common room and our students, who I feel have really applied themselves to combat a dreadful war in the way that one would expect our students to do so in upholding the values that the university aspires to lead. And I'd like to thank our GCR president, Shiraz Kasumi, for the amazing job that she has done in providing leadership and in helping to guide students and faculty and the college as a whole towards, well, towards better solutions, even if we haven't achieved them. And no one has been more receptive to student concerns or welfare than our acting warden, Nandini Gupta, who I think in her messaging has demonstrated to the university as a whole what a head of house can do to make a difference in trying to get the messaging right with their students. The way that she's interacted, I think, has been a role model to the better heads of house. And I am proud that she has been leading our college this year. She has done so with distinction, and we are in her debt. Through it all, the Middle East Center has continued with its mission to provide a space for meeting and thought and dialogue through our seminars and through our lectures and through our conversations in hall and over coffees in the gallery here. Our very first event this year was with Nathan Thrall and Abid Salama, who spoke just 3 days after the 7th of October. They discussed Nathan's new book, which we were delighted to see was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction this year. We didn't know how the audience, still traumatized by the shock of 7 October, would respond. We got a sense of where our community was going when they received what was one of the longest ovations I can remember in this hall, in response to the very sensitive, personal, and human way they engaged with the situation in Israel and Palestine. So we were then moved to try and use this space to bring together people across the Palestine-Israel divide to consider what the political options might be at a point where we optimistically thought we would be after the Gaza conflict. We had, I think, meetings in this hall that were informative to all of us. You heard things you agreed with, you heard things you didn't agree with, but it created a meeting space that I think was valuable, and in that I think we fulfilled our purpose. And as the winter seminar drew to a close, we began to think about what we would do to use the opportunity of the Antonius Lecture to take stock of what has been, as I said, one of the most difficult years the Center has faced in recent memory. When the fellows came together to think of whom to invite, our unanimous first choice was Dean Amani Jamani, the Dean of the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs and Edward S. Sanford Professor of Politics at Princeton. Dr. Jamal's scholarship covers the politics of the Middle East and North Africa. She covers mass and political behavior, political development and democratization, inequality and economic segregation, Muslim immigration, gender, race, religion, and class. But it's for the work that she has been doing in terms of public opinion polling across the Arab world with the Arab Barometer Project, and specifically the work that she has done examining what people are thinking in Palestine itself. In this year of deafness, the importance of listening has been proven more important than anything. And for that reason, knowing of her work, we felt that no one could better crown this year with meaningful content of value to our understanding of where we are since before the 7th of October, at present, and from that, hopefully, where we might be heading. I would ask you all to join me in welcoming the 46th George Antonius Memorial Lecturer, Dean Amani Jalal. Amani Jalal.
Thank you so much, Eugene, for that wonderful introduction. Thank you, all of you, for coming out this evening. It's such an honor and delight to be here this evening. I see many familiar faces. It's a true pleasure and joy to be here. And it's a tremendous honor to be delivering this lecture with such esteemed colleagues. I was almost blushing while I was sitting there listening to the name. So it's really such an honor to be here. Thank you all. So I'm presenting some findings from the Arab Barometer Survey. For those of you who don't know, for the last 15 years or so, my colleagues and I have run the Arab Barometer Project, which we think is one of the most, and we applaud ourselves, that it's one of the more rigorous and scientifically based sources of public opinion data on the Arab world. For the longest time, this public opinion data set did not exist. For those of you who were students, many years ago, over two decades ago, like myself, it would be very common to sit in PhD seminars and people would show data on public opinion in Latin America, public opinion in Africa, and then there would be this like big sort of glaring gap on the Middle East. Well, everybody knows what the Middle East street thinks and believes, or this is all part of the Muslim world. So it's always like this discrediting or discounting what the Arab world thought and believed. And it was often portrayed as this very hegemonic, monolithic, almost stereotypical, overwhelmingly stereotypical sort of depictions of what Arabs and Muslims thought in terms of the Arab world. So we were keen on developing an instrument and a source of data that reliably captured public opinion data from across the region. So we've been in existence since 2006. The results today are part of our more recent Wave 8 results. And it so happens, I'll go over all of this, but it just so happens that we were in the field conducting Wave 8 surveys across numerous Arab countries, but we were in Palestine starting at the end of September. Typically, our surveys are in the field for approximately 2 weeks. So we were in the field in Palestine end of September all the way up to October 8th. So when the unfortunate attacks happened on October 7th, we were wrapping up our survey. So we have accurate data for all the talk about what Gazans think, what Gazans believe, what Palestinians think, what Palestinians believe. We have accurate data depicting what was actually going on the ground in the few days right before October 7th, which is extremely important because a lot of what we're seeing right now in Gaza today in terms of the ongoing war, has been predicated on this assumption, well, this Gazans sort of voted Hamas into power back in 2006, and therefore they are all supporters of Hamas. So we have some data there. I can talk more about that particular point. The fact that 50% of Gaza was not born in 2006, it also is a very important point to keep in mind. But really quickly, the Arab Barometer, it's a nonpartisan research network that provides insights into the social, political, and economic attitudes and values of ordinary citizens across the Arab world. And the Arab Barometer is the longest standing and largest repository of publicly available data. Our data is publicly available. You can download it from our website. It's not for profit. You don't have to pay any hidden fees or anything like that. And our mission is to track attitudes and behavior, build institutional capacity in the region, and disseminate knowledge about ordinary citizens living in the Middle East and North Africa. To date, we've conducted over more than 125,000 personal interviews, 89 nationally representative surveys, 8 waves across 16 countries, providing trend data on how views have changed over time. Disaggregated data allows for both inter and intra-country comparisons, and the data are open source and publicly available at arabbarometer.org. We have an English website and an Arabic website. We also have a simplified portal that allows you to conduct some, bivariate analysis, crosstabs and whatnot. You can also get descriptive statistics off that website. And we have country and topical reports, including the one that has findings discussed today. Everything is available on our website. This just gives you a sense of the dates of when we were in the region this year. Palestine, September 28, October 8. This includes West Bank and Gaza. But we were also in Tunisia during the time period, so we have data before and after October 7th, and then every other country we were in the field after October 7th. So our Palestine data consists of 1,189 Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. All our surveys are face-to-face. We don't rely on self-responses like through any other medium. We base our sampling based on area probability sampling, complex survey design stratified by governor and level of urbanity. And we fielded from September 28th through October 8th, 2023. Our partners, the Palestine Center for Policy and Survey Research, Dr. Khalid Shakaki, who I'm sure you all know, who's visited here as well. So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. When we sort of just start out and we ask people in the region, are you in favor of the normalization projects going on in the region or normalization between Arab states and Israel? What you see here is that for all Palestinians, there's just a lot of opposition to normalization. Vast majority, upwards of almost 90% oppose or strongly oppose. But what's interesting here is when we disaggregate the data by West Bank and Gaza, there's a lot more opposition to normalization in the West Bank than in Gaza. And the way we sort of describe this is that, you know, the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, has felt that the PA would be threatened most by normalization, whereas Hamas, because it has its close ties to Qatar, might see itself benefiting from stronger normalization in the long run. Nevertheless, what we find is that there's a lot of opposition, but the opposition is far greater in the West Bank than in Gaza. What is the preferred solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, right? What is this outcome? So in our survey, we ask about, do you support a two-state solution? Do you support a one-state solution, a confederation, or something else? Basically, the something else typically is other, and people can write in the response. Most of the responses that are written in are armed conflict, right? So war. But you'll see that the vast majority of Palestinians will cite a two-state solution, despite the failure of Oslo. Despite the fact that Oslo has failed for over two decades, the vast majority of Palestinians still support a two-state solution over any other option. The one-state solution, in my opinion, has far more support in the West among diaspora communities than among the Palestinians. When we break this down by West Bank and Gaza, you'll see that even in Gaza, there's slightly even more support for the two-state solution than there is among West Bankers. So this is Gaza before October 7. Even armed conflict, there's greater support for armed conflict in the West Bank than there is in Gaza. It's 1 in 5, so I'm not saying that's a small number, but nevertheless, the momentum is for two-state solution. When we ask, this is an important point in terms of U.S. standing on the Middle East and this particular conflict. Do you believe the U.S. versus China is better equipped to address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Across the board, increasingly, Palestinians believe China would be better. And this is right at the eve of October 7th, since this has grown. So on this issue, only 13% think America is better. 26% believe China is better. 16% believe they're equally good, 37% equally bad. But here you go, here in Gaza at least, 15% believe the American policy would be better, 19% China. A good 1 in 4 still believe both might be good for the solution, knowing full well that outside forces will need to play an important role in any sort of future solution between Palestinians and Israelis. This is also to give you a sense about what happened in a country like Tunisia, where we were in the field before and after October 7. Views of normalization took a hit in Tunisia. What we saw is that there was already low support. About 12% of Tunisians supported normalization. After October 7, that fell to 1%. In every other country, we weren't in the field during October 7, but we rely on the previous wave, Wave 7. What you'll see is that support for normalization was a lot higher in our Wave 7, 2002-2022, versus where it is now. So again, normalization with Israel is going to be very contingent upon what's going on in this conflict. And for all those that say, basically try to argue that, Arab and Palestinian and Muslim attitudes towards Israel are static, our data has shown repeatedly that it will fluctuate with what's going on in the moment, in the political moment. Again, preference for a two-state solution also in Tunisia took a hit. It went down from 66% to 50%. But in many other Arab countries, even after October 7th, you'll see that support for the two-state solution even went up. this is Mauritania, this is Jordan, and this is Morocco. Only in Tunisia it went down. So again, this idea that there is no path towards a two-state solution or reconciliation with Israel in the long run is not supported in our public opinion data. Not only do we see it among the Palestinians, but among citizens across the Arab region, and in fact, people are keeping their eye on the future of normalization and whether that's going to be beneficial to many countries, especially with the security sort of agreements happening and the issue of Iran. That we can talk about that more in the Q&A. So Biden's top priority in MENA should be the Palestinian question. What we see across the Arab world, despite all the other problems in the Arab world, whether it's economic right now, whether it's the rising unemployment, inflation, there are no shortages of problems that Arab citizens and states have to deal with across the region. The vast majority of citizens believe that the Biden administration's top priority should be the Palestine question. And this has increased in Tunisia from 24% to 59%. In every Arab country, we're seeing that this is moving upwards in really major leaps and bounds. So again, about 43% in Mauritania, 42% in Jordan, 27% there in Morocco, and 21% in Tunisia. So again, this is a big issue for citizens in the region. We've seen the demonstrations across the region and many other countries as well. When we ask citizens how they describe what's going on in Gaza, you'll see that there is variation, but nevertheless, Jordan, which is has a significant Palestinian population, the vast majority see what's happening in Gaza as a genocide, about 44% there, or plurality, 28% believe it's a massacre, 9% say ethnic cleansing, 9% say mass killing, whereas in Morocco, you'll see the plurality believes it's a massacre. They don't call it a genocide. So again, there is sort of different ways of characterizing what's going on in Gaza. We believe we have a reason why we believe that Morocco might diverge from many Arab countries in terms of what's going on, or at least how they see what's going on in the region. So when we ask, well, what are the US commitments towards defending Israeli rights versus Palestinian rights in every single Arab country here, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Morocco, Mauritania, the vast majority believe that the United States defends Israeli rights, 81% in Jordan, 73% in Kuwait, 72% in Lebanon, 60% in Morocco, Mauritania. When we ask whether the United States will defend Palestinian rights, basically that does not track at all with Arab citizens. This is where the United States tends to lose credibility with Arab populations. Kuwait still, despite Kuwait having a very, some of the most favorable opinions about the U.S. since the 1991 Gulf War, you see that they also don't believe the United States is doing much to defend Palestinian rights. Okay, so that's just giving you a sense of how Palestinians themselves see the conflict. Let's just look at what were the economic conditions in Gaza and the West Bank before October 7. We asked Palestinians, how would you describe the current economic situation in your country? So a lot of time I get questions about, well, why did Hamas do this? Why would Hamas choose October 7? I mean, I really have no good answer. But these data might give us a little glimpse into what was going on the Palestinian street or within the Palestinian street before October 7. Current economic situation in your country, percent saying it's very good, good, bad, very bad. The vast majority of Palestinians believe their economic situations are very bad. You know, we've had like skyrocketing inflation, cost of living, donor aid is down, salaries, the PA is not able to pay its own its public sector employees. Hamas is also similarly struggling to pay its public sector employees in Gaza. So the situation in the West Bank and Gaza is not necessarily a rosy one economically before October 7. By all accounts, since October 7, things have even become worse. I mean, Gaza's in devastation right now. The West Bank is similarly struggling. But look here when we break it down by West Bank and Gaza. Very bad, 55% of Gazans say the economic situation is very bad. 38% say it's bad. So only 6% of Gazans could say that the economic situation is good. You're talking about 94% of the population saying that their economic situation was bad or very bad. When we think about the long-term effects of an economic blockade or economic siege on Gaza, what that means for the daily, everyday life of citizens in that region, we need to be mindful of these data here. Now, similarly, we'll talk about the PA also on the West Bank. It's not like things are great on the West Bank either. This has been the dilemma, and we can talk more about that also moving forward. Current economic situation in the country, just looking across time from 2016, both in the West Bank and Gaza, the percent saying that the situation in the country is good or very good, it's been on the decline. In the West Bank, it's down 33 to 28 across the last 9 years, but in Gaza, look it, it's been from 20 to 6%. So you're seeing a staggering decline. It was never, they never really were great to begin with, but they've been on the decline. The economic situation in the country will improve in the coming years, like kind of like, do you have aspirations that things will get better in the future? Again, what we see is that the vast majority believe it will be much worse or somewhat worse, but it's pretty comparable across the West Bank and Gaza, with even people in Gaza being slightly more optimistic than the people in the West Bank. So again, the economic situation, the economic outlook of citizens in the region is very dire. When we ask people what is the most important challenge facing the country, you'll see that most Palestinians will say economic situation, then they'll cite instability, then they'll cite corruption. When we look at Gaza here, 41% will cite the economic situation, then the Gazans will rank instability and then corruption. But basically, these are the top issues here. In the West Bank, we have also concerns of settler terrorism. This has been a growing problem in terms of what's happening on the West Bank, as has been being picked up with some of the media. But more or less, the economic situation has been the Palestinian story and the Palestinian struggle. On top of that, corruption in the state institutions. These are the state institutions of the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas and the Hamas-led government in Gaza. 54% believe that corruption is what? Sorry, corruption is. Let me get this right. Corruption is widespread to, 54 to a large extent, 31 to a medium. That's like 85% believe that corruption is widespread in the ranks of the government. If you're in the West Bank interviewing anybody, they'll also say that tell you a similar story. It's a much larger problem in the West Bank, at least, but nevertheless, on the eve of October 7, 72% of Gazans believe corruption was a widespread problem. And just looking at this across time, in the West Bank, perceptions of corruption have gone up by 10 percentage points in the last 9 years. Despite it being at 72% right before October 7, it's gone down in Gaza. So at least perceptions of corruption, you've seen a 10-point improvement there. Government is cracking down on corruption, just to give you a sense of whether citizens believe their governments are doing anything. To a small extent, not at all. It's where the majority sentiment is. More West Bankers are frustrated with the corruption situation than in Gaza, but nevertheless, Gaza still is within 57 percentage points of people believing that more needs to be done on corruption. Okay, so we have a series of questions that get at food insecurity. So the first question we sort of ask is, were you worried that there wouldn't be enough food to feed your family within the last month? That's the first question. What we found is that about 68% of Palestinians said yes, they did worry that they wouldn't be able to feed their family within the next 30 days. This is a far bigger problem in Gaza than it is in the West Bank. In Gaza, it almost reaches 78%. So you're talking about like three-fourths of the citizens of Gaza reporting before October 7th that they worried about feeding their families. When we ask them, can you afford food, you'll see, again, a very similar story. Here's about 78% of Palestinians saying to a great extent or medium extent, they think it was a problem. The affordability of food is a problem. When you think about Gazans, that number is closer to 75%. Again, three-fourths of the population. But on the West Bank, it's quite large as well. It's almost hitting 80% of the West Bank. Finally, when we ask the question, in actuality, the food that we bought did not last and we did not have enough money to buy more food, right, in the last 30 days, you'll see that often true, sometimes true, that's about 58%, but again, it was far more true in Gaza, far more likely to be sometimes true in Gaza. That's close to 75%. Again, 3/4 of the population mentioning that they really can't even have access or afford food. So there's serious economic problems in Gaza at the eve of October 7th. And you'll see that across time from 2021, from the last wave, from wave 7, for two or three years, like the cost of food prices and inflation, that in a place like Gaza, it jumped from 51 to 75%, from half the population to 3/4 of the population saying they couldn't afford food. But similarly in the West Bank, it doubled from 24 to 47%. So the ongoing problems in the West Bank and Gaza economically are really severe, and they're only worse now. So the political conditions, I'm good on time, right?
Oh, you're great on time.
Perfect. Okay, so oftentimes people say, well, where's Palestinian sentiment on governance, especially on Hamas or the Palestinian Authority? Well, we ask people, how much trust do you have in the government in the West Bank? The government in the West Bank, of course, is Mahmoud Abbas's PA. How much trust do you have in the government in Gaza, which is basically the Hamas-led government? What we find that by October 8th, 57% of the Palestinians said they have no trust at all in the West Bank government. 19% said not a lot of trust. About 18%, less than 1 in 5, say a great deal of trust or quite a lot of trust. On the Hamas side, we have a similar story, slightly more trust in the Hamas government, but that's at 29%, 1 in 3. 2/3 basically saying they have a little or not a lot of trust in the Hamas-led government on the eve of October 7th. And so what we see that in both the West Bank and Gaza across time over the last 9 years, support for the Hamas-led government has been on the decline, you know, 6 percentage points. The bigger decline, of course, is on the West Bank, where it's gone down from 29 to 17%. But here, when we look at support for the PA or the Hamas-led government, we're not seeing a lot of great support. 1 in 3, right? And you know, if you factor in the number of public sector workers working for each of the governments, you know, those people are going to be more likely to report that they support their governments. For all the talk about citizens of Gaza being basically Hamas waving supporters and diehard supporters and fanatics, nothing in our data substantiates that claim. So we can come back to that in Q&A. Responsiveness, I mean, these are citizens. 50% of Gaza was born after 2006 in a Hamas-led government, and there's been no election since. Responsiveness of government, the percent saying that the government is very responsive or largely responsive. The vast majority of Palestinians believe their government is not responsive, not very responsive or not responsive at all. That is like, again, 79%. And when we break this down by Gaza West Bank, we see some slight variations. Maybe the PA is considered less responsive than Hamas. Hamas appears to be slightly more responsive, but still the trends are speak for themselves. Like, these governments are not necessarily responsive to citizen demands. Now, if we had officials from the PA here, they would probably say, well, you know, we're a Palestinian Authority, we're leading, trying to build a nation. We don't have a partner for peace. There's all, you know, I want to make sure that we pay attention to that argument as well, because those are arguments that have been made. But nevertheless, the story is that, you know, when I do interviews in Palestine, citizens will often say to me, we used to be occupied by one people, by one force, and now we're occupied by two. Now it's like the Israel and the Palestinian governments, right? So it's like this dual layer of oppression on the people. Do you trust Hamas? So when we ask Palestinians in general, the 52% say they by October 8th do not trust Hamas at all. 20% said not a lot of trust, so together that's 72%. What we find is that there was 23% support, almost 1 in 4 support for Hamas. When we break that by the West Bank and Gaza, you'll see that there's a slight more trust in Gaza than there is on the West Bank, but even there, 29%, 1 in 3 again, trust Hamas, about 2/3 do not. trust in the president. This is even gets sadder because there is no trust in the Mahmoud Abbas-led government. And so when we were, why is this a problem? Because when we start talking about the day after, if we ever get to the day after, everybody's thinking about, well, what legitimate force will come in to govern, right? And if the PA does not have a lot of also sort of legitimacy among the Palestinian people in Gaza or the West Bank, this also poses a dilemma. So about only 22% have a great deal of trust or a lot of trust in President Mahmoud Abbas. Of course, that trust is in the West Bank, there's less even trust for Mahmoud Abbas than in Gaza. So there is a crisis of leadership right now, not in the way it's often portrayed in the media, but a crisis of leadership that these governments have been imposed and have not been able to deliver on sort of the core issues. Yes, corruption is a problem, but remember, these governments, especially the Palestinian National Authority, was created to deliver a Palestinian state. And for 20 years, that has not happened. So that has eroded confidence of the among the Palestinians towards the government. Really quickly, when we ask about party affiliation, you'll see that Fatah still is the more dominant party. 22% say no party, 14% refuse to answer. So there's a lot of sort of like, you know, weeding out here. But of the people who did respond, 30% say they support Fatah, 21% they said they support Hamas. And if we break it down here, West Bank and Gaza, you'll see that support for Hamas was larger in Gaza than the West Bank. Although some recent polling we've seen shows that Hamas is getting support in the West Bank, and maybe it's being challenged right now in Gaza. I'm happy to talk more about that in the Q&A. Again, the political situation was not a rosy one. Citizens in Palestine, under both the Hamas government and the PA, were reporting that their freedom to express their opinions was being hindered by those governments, not by the Israeli occupation. We're talking not to say that the Israeli occupation is not a problem. I'm just talking about what's happening domestically. The freedom to express was not guaranteed at all or to a limited extent. That was 67%. And you'll see that in the West Bank, there was a sense that the freedoms were being curbed even further. But there was also curbing of freedoms in Gaza, right? So it increasingly became the case that you talk to friends and family or colleagues who say, like, you have to watch what you say. You can't say things on the street. If you call Mahmoud Abbas corrupt, you know, Palestinian vehicle, police vehicle will pick you up and take you into detention. That there was a lot of self-censoring emerging on the West Bank as well. Freedom to express opinions across time. What you see is that in the West Bank across time, fewer people believe they can express their opinions freely and fairly. That's about a decline of 10 percentage points. Again, globally, we're also seeing a lot of this democratic backsliding, so that's like fitting the trend as well. But also in Gaza, you're seeing that it's slightly on the decline. Again, the rights, similar story about the rights to protest and the right to freedoms for the press, that across time, a lot of these freedoms are being limited. So again, this idea that, you know, Palestinians are able to exercise their democratic rights, at least we're not necessarily being protected by the existing governments. With the PA actually faring worse than Hamas in most of these cases. So views on foreign powers, just to go back there, favorability of the United States, no surprise, very unfavorable even before October 7th, so it's only gotten worse. And again, for everybody who says that, you know, the Middle East will always be inherently anti-American, I just want you to see from 2021 to 2023, with Biden's policy slightly maybe improving coming off of Donald Trump, we saw some tick upwards. So we do see the fluctuations. Kuwait does not resemble other Arab countries. Remember, Morocco, as you'll see, does not resemble other Arab countries. So there is variation that we have to leverage. This is not a region that is dogmatically opposed to the West or to the United States. American President Joseph Biden's foreign policy towards MENA, majority believes that it's bad or very bad. There's very little change there. Percent of Tunisians saying that they have a favorable view of the U.S. This is a very good example. Again, looking at before and after October 7, you'll see that there was a decrease of from 40% to 10% after October 7. So that the U.S. perception is largely shaped by what's happening in the region and in this Gaza war right now. Biden's policies towards MENA are very good or good. You'll see there's a decrease from 29 to 6% in Tunisia. Remember, Tunisia is like, is a lovely country. I love to go to Tunisia, but it's like not embroiled in any of the, you know, the immediate conflict, but nevertheless very much influenced by what's happening. Favorability, here's also just breaking down favorability of the United States by country. Morocco tends to be very favorable to the U.S. A lot of people will say that we've seen this uptick, especially after the United States announced that it was going to support Morocco's stance on the Western Sahara. So it talks about favorable policies. But Mauritania, Jordan, Lebanon, Kuwait, even Kuwait, this is the one that, you know, they have streets named after George Bush, right, in Kuwait, right? So this is interesting. In every country other than Morocco, compared to the earlier wave, you'll see that favorability scores with the United States are down. China's benefiting from this. China's benefiting. We just had a piece out in Foreign Affairs 2 days ago that talks about how China is reaping the benefits of what is going on in the region. China is far more favorable these days than the United States. 42% of Arabs now believe that they have favorable or somewhat favorable opinions of China. So in terms of thinking about soft power influence in the region, the U.S. is losing it, China is gaining. You know, and again, thinking about soft power, sort of, I can go on and on about this, something that we really pay attention when we teach about authoritarianism, but this authoritarian model that you can bring up the middle class, you can live the good life, but it has to be authoritarian. This is gaining traction, right? We're seeing a lot, you know, not to name many different countries, but that this idea of taking a critically assessing the benefits of what liberal democracy can bring is certainly presented by this model that can challenge sort of the U.S. or Western sort of commitments to democracy worldwide. So China is benefiting across time. They have risen from 34% to 43%. The Chinese president also has been gaining, Xi's become much more popular in the region across time as well. And his foreign policy is more favorable. And when we look at whether October 7th shifted opinion in favor of China, we see a slight shift in Tunisia from 70 to 75% towards China favorability. And we look at Xi's policies, we see that there was wasn't really a big shift, and if anything, it sort of didn't operate in the same direction that it operated here. But so I guess what we can say is that the jury's still out on whether it's going to really push citizens towards China, but at least a lot of the trend data that we're seeing seems to indicate that this is happening. The China image in MENA post October 7th, what we see that in at least Morocco and Jordan after October, when we compare the wave 7 to wave 8, China's image is on the rise in a positive way. It's static, somewhat static in Tunisia, so 6 percentage points. Mauritania does not sort of reflect what's going on, and that could be more regionally determined. Okay, so when we think about US versus China policies, better for the Israel-Palestine conflict, I think I showed you this just earlier, but this is just a few more countries in the mix here. You'll see that the vast majority of Arab countries believe China is better on the Arab-Israeli conflict than the United States. So the United States is losing out in terms of its role as a fair arbiter. The United Kingdom, at one point, was much more favorable in terms of favorability of the United Kingdom, at least among Jordanian Moroccans. This is 2000, the seventh wave versus the eighth wave. You'll see that these have taken huge hits on the decline, France. So it's not only a US story, but it's basically a Western story. The Arab world is losing faith in Western countries across the board. And again, you know, thinking about where the orientation is, the Middle East has been oriented west. The Arab world has oriented itself west, but now there's China on the horizon. Favorability of Russia. Russia, we see, is sort of static. We haven't seen a big boon towards Russia, not in the way that we've seen it towards China, but nevertheless, Russia still remains more popular than the United States in the region right now. and if we look at Putin's policies, you'll see that more or less we see a lot of static sort of support here, but nevertheless, about a one in four believe that the policies towards MENA are very good. We don't see any significant shift in Tunisia when we sort of use our regression discontinuity design here. There's no significant shift in support of Russia, not in the way that we see it in support of China. Saudi Arabia seems to be benefiting as well. So again, if we're thinking about what's happening in the region, about 38% believe that they have a favorable opinion towards Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia today announced that it was not going to renew its petro agreement with the United States. So there does appear maybe, this might even be more favorable to where Saudi Arabia stands. So this is something to keep. We will keep our eye on. And then you look at the foreign policy of Mohammed bin Salman, you'll see that the support is on the rise. It's almost doubled over the last, from wave 7 to wave 8. Iran favorability has not necessarily taken a surge. A lot of people thought that this was going to play in the brilliant hands of Iran, that, you know, the Arab citizens are like in this, like, you know, future alliance with the Iranian regime. We're not necessarily seeing that. Here's wave 7 in terms of favorability of Iran versus wave 8. It's about 30% to 28%. Does Ali Khamenei's foreign policy towards MENA, was it very popular? Again, we're not seeing very major shifts here from 16 to 21%. That's 5 percentage points. Again, not these huge gains. What we do see, though, in Tunisia is that it did rise after October 7 from 29% to 41%. So there is that potential in a country like Tunisia, but we're not seeing it in other Arab countries just yet. Turkey did not benefit from anything happening in the region. If anything, Turkey's popularity, Erdogan's popularity is on the decline. Do people want stronger economic ties with Turkey? This has been a story that's been on the decline. We see a huge decline between 2021 and 2023. I'm going a little bit quicker now because we have a lot of foreign policy. Erdogan's popularity is also on the decline. So I'd be happy to come back to these. But nevertheless, it's not this story that, oh, Iran, Turkey, Russia, that axis is gaining momentum. The real story is China, and that the West is losing its soft power sort of credibility in the region. Qatar is definitely benefiting from what's happening, like Saudi Arabia. So again, like looking towards the Gulf countries, about 60% believe that they have a very favorable view of the Qatar government, and that view is stronger in Gaza than the West Bank. Mohammed bin Zayed's foreign policy, about 1 in 5 believe that it's very good and it's very strong. It's sort of equal across the West Bank and Gaza. Qatar seems to have a lot more favorability than what's going on in the UAE. So really quickly, changes are driven by views of the war in Gaza rather than an immediate reaction to the October 7th attacks on Israel. So what's going on right now, how the world is responding. Western soft power has declined in MENA and likely beyond. China has been a clear beneficiary from U.S. policies towards Gaza. U.S. and Western decline support is not inevitable, but depends on their policy choices. Views of regional powers have not shifted overly in response to Gaza, maybe except in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, I would say. And regionally, support for the two-state solution remains the preferred option. I look forward to taking your questions and having a discussion. Thank you so much.